Hi, you're listening to the Table Podcast. Today's teaching is titled Modernism and Icebergs and Architecture and Complex Simplicity.
So, I'm going to start by reading a short story, maybe the shortest story ever. and this is a story that was reportedly written by Ernest Hemingway, who you can see here. This is also the image that everybody who's ever written has of themselves while writing. Mountains in the background, clouds, some sort of cowboy vest, the typewriter. Yeah, that's what we all think we look like. Yeah. So this story, the story behind the story goes that in the mid-20s, the reason I'm going to bring this story up is because this story gets dragged out every time somebody tries to explain Hemingway's style, or anytime someone's trying to teach writing and they're trying to tell people that less is more, because the story that he wrote really captures a sort of succinct minimalism that we associate with Hemingway. So the story goes that the members of the Algonquin Round Table, if you know your early 20th century history, you'll know about them, which was a group of sort of writers and intellectuals and critics, people like Dorothy Parker, Robert Benchley, Alexander Wolcott, occasionally Harpo Marx, if you know who that is, and they used to meet at the Algonquin Hotel for lunch. So one day Hemingway joined them, and they bet him $10 that he couldn't write a novel in just 6 words. So the story goes that he grabbed a napkin, and he wrote this story, he passed it around the table, and then he collected his winnings. So, we're going to take a look at it. Here it is. And read it very quickly. This is the world's shortest short story. It's pretty devastating, actually, when you start to think about it. Now, the story behind the story is often regarded as sort of apocryphal. It's the kind of myth-making that Hemingway was really involved in. But chances are he did write this at some point and then made up the story behind it to show how great he was. but I'm using it today not because I want to just teach a lesson in literature, but because I think that there's something to be gained by understanding the sort of idiosyncratic way that Hemingway wrote in terms of understanding our own sacred texts, our relationship with whatever God is, and our relationships with each other, especially in an age where so much of our communication now sort of happens textually, right? Twitter, Facebook, whatever. You're reading instead of engaging with somebody personally, and so you lose a lot of what comes from personal conversations. So, for those of you that are keeping score, that was my thesis statement. and you can also see how I'm applying the sort of esoteric theoretical concepts that I deal with in university to life, which is what Tim talked about last week. So, anyway, so we'll stop talking about it. Let's just go ahead and break this thing down and see what happens. So, the first thing that we notice with a story like this is its genre. Now, it's not a literary genre, but it is a genre of writing, one that's more or less disappeared today. What we're looking at here is essentially what you would call a classified ad. Now, for you kids that aren't old enough to remember the days before eBay and Kijiji, in the olden days, like up to the mid-90s, if you wanted to sell something to a bunch of strangers, you would call up your local newspaper, and you would take out a classified ad. And these ads would appear with hundreds of other ones in the back of the paper somewhere, and people would have to pay by the word to get these things in there, sometimes by the letter. And so they would do that in order to sort of reach more people than they could with just word of mouth or like a thing on a lamppost. And so that's exactly what we're seeing here. So this is written in the 20s. Obviously, classified ads were a big deal at the time. And so what you have in the first line is your announcement. You have something for sale. The second line is what is for sale, and the third line is the item's quality. So in 6 words, you know, if you're paying by the word, you can get a pretty good idea, give whoever's looking for something a pretty good idea of what you've got to sell. But I think what's interesting here about this as a story is what Hemingway's genius is that the words he chooses and the arrangements of those words turn these 6 words from just a simple announcement into something that is a story of tragedy. So, like, let's think about it. So let's change some of the words around and see what happens, right? So if we do this, it's only four words, even cheaper, right? But you lose something of what the story is telling. Same thing if you go like this, right? There's something different about brand new versus never worn. There's something, much darker. Or here, baby shoes for sale, exclamation point, right? Completely changes the story in every way. This is not the same story we were telling. And so that, each of these things accomplish the same thing. They tell you something is for sale. They tell you what that thing is. But they remove the story, and they remove the pathos that's sort of accomplished in Hemingway's version. In the original, we can sort of begin to imagine the person behind the ad. Perhaps a heartbroken mother who's lost a child, through a miscarriage or a stillbirth. She had bought these shoes with a great deal of expectation, but now they're heartbreaking, and so heartbreaking that she can't even keep them near her. Perhaps the ad is from a poor couple that have just lost a child and need to basically get rid of everything they have just to pay these medical expenses. And the terseness of the ad reinforces this idea. They can't spare an extra penny for one more letter. Realistically, how much could you really make off of a pair of baby shoes, right? Yet, through grief or desperation, the characters in Hemingway's story are eager enough to get rid of them that they would take out an ad in a newspaper to try and sell them. There's really, when you start to think about it that way, you start to think behind it, there's actually a lot within these six words. Really, pages could be written about the sort of grief that somebody would suffer, right? If they lost a child, they needed to sell what had belonged to them. But Hemingway expresses it in two words, never worn. And this is really, I use this story as an example because this is the essence of Hemingway's style. If you ever read any of his other books, a lot of times people read them for the first time and they think, like, what is this? There's nothing to this. And the reason is because it's so stripped back. And it has to do with this thing that he developed, which is called the theory of omission, or more commonly, it's called the iceberg theory, right? So we've probably all seen this image. It's a composite image. I don't think there's a camera in the world that could actually take that picture. But it's the idea of the iceberg, right? So when you see an iceberg, what you're actually seeing is only about 10% of the entire structure. The other 90% is underwater, and that's what keeps up. So Hemingway had this theory that he wrote about. So I'll just read it to you. He said, if a writer of prose knows enough about what he is writing about, he may omit things that he knows, and the reader, if the writer is writing truly enough, it's a perfect Hemingway sentence there, will have a feeling of those things as strongly as if the writer had stated them. The dignity of movement of an iceberg is due to only 1/8 of it being above the water. Right, so he said 1/8, now they say 1/9, but you get the idea. There's a lot going on below the surface is the idea. And that's essentially what Hemingway was doing. The reason I'm talking about it is because the thing that's really interesting about this approach to writing is the interplay that then occurs between the words and the space that surround them. The words become a structure, a skeleton, the frame around which the narrative and the characters and the themes form this amorphous, sort of intelligible and remarkable thing that we call literature. Your favorite book is not your favorite book solely because of the individual words, but it's how an author arranges them into sentences and organizes those sentences into paragraphs, and before fitting those paragraphs into chapters, and the result is a narrative that's driven by character and setting. And the amazing thing that great literature does is it turns the unfamiliar into the familiar. Those characters, when they're well written, become mirrors in which we can see ourselves. Their struggles, their joys, their accomplishments become ours. And we inhabit the space between the words. We fill in the gaps with our own experiences, and we take on the heartbreak that swirls around the page, as in the case of this story. We become that mother desperate to sell the shoes of a lost baby. And in turn, we understand a little bit more of what it's like what it means to be somebody else. It's in the spaces that we get to become a part of what the author is doing. The author is the architect of the narrative building, and our job is to make meaning of and exist within that building. And the reason I bring Hemingway is because I think almost no other writer in the history of the English language was as brave as Hemingway, which he would love to hear me say. Stop sentence right there. but in brave in Hemingway in regard to how much space he allows his readers to fill in. Maybe Joseph Conrad did it better, but we're not talking about him today. So, but this idea of the author as architect, it's a sort of expand on that a little bit. I'm gonna bring in another 20th century artist who, incidentally, spent a significant part of his life in Oak Park, which is the same Chicago suburb that lays claim to being the birthplace and the home, the early home of Ernest Hemingway. And I spent some time in Oak Park this summer while I was attending a Hemingway conference. Clearly, I spent a lot of time with this guy. And for the sake of full disclosure, the connections that I'm going to be making now are at the very least inspired in part by the author Paul Hendrickson, who gave a keynote address on the topic of the roots of Hemingway and the architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who I'm also going to talk about. And so I'm going to show a clip because, as Hendrickson suggested, Wright's architecture is doing something similar to Hemingway's literature in its use of space. And I think the best way to sort of appreciate that is to experience it just a little bit, even in the limited way that this allows. So I'm going to show a clip here from a PBS documentary by Ken Burns. If you guys know Ken Burns, you'll notice his style very quickly. Just sort of talking about this building. It's a church in Oak Park that Frank Lloyd Wright designed. And I think it has really interesting things to say about what we're talking about here. So here we go. Is the sound? Could we set up a sound? No. What's that? Yeah.
In 1905, the Unitarian
Park
burned to the ground. Its progressive minister and most of his congregation wanted to replace it with a bold new architectural statement. They gave the contract to one of their own members, Frank Lloyd Wright. "Why have the steeple of the little white church?" he said. "Why point to heaven? Why not build a temple to man, appropriate to his uses, as a meeting place?" The exterior of his Unity Temple was unlike any other church anywhere. Some disappointed worshippers compared it to a prison gatehouse, an ice factory, a Mayan handball court. But the interior was something else again.
You come in the back door of that chapel. You could hear the church, but you couldn't see. And then you made the three turns. Every turn is a very difficult thing. A right angle turn is a wrench. But he knew you didn't go very far. Small church. And then being forced to turn makes you start over a new life. And by slowing you down with a right angle turn, he prepares you intensely for the surprise of the religious feeling.
When you come into the church, you come in upstairs onto the auditorium floor, which is like a raised platform, which therefore comes to be a spiritual plane. In other words, it's as if you've risen up to a plane which is floating literally in air. You're surrounded by these depressed cloisters on all four sides. Standing on this raised plane with space dropping away from you on every side, it's like being on a kind of plateau, a mountaintop out in the landscape. And I think that's what gives it spirituality.
one big building, but I think it's the biggest space in America. It's a square inside, like the old meeting houses. And as in the old meeting houses, the preacher is on one side, and then people are on the other three sides. And they're looking into each other's faces as well as into his. So there's an enormous sense of community.
It's an extraordinary building that had staggering civic dignity to it. And what Wright wanted to do was show that you can make a modern, monumental public place. That was the real importance of Unity Temple.
Here's a photo of that place. When I was in Oak Park, it was closed for renovations, so I never actually got to go in and see it, so I had to pull this off the internet. But you can kind of see what they're talking about, this square room where everybody is sort of on different sides, and the lines sort of draw you around. Now, there's some interesting things that were said by Wright in this thing, much of which in some churches might get my speaking privileges revoked for encouraging heresy, but that's why I don't go to one of those churches. His idea of building a monument to man, as he puts it, we would say, you know, humanity, results in something much more beautiful than I think the language that he uses sort of leads us to believe. So rather than, as in the architectural mission of many churches, building a monument that works to express exactly what God is according to the theological doctrine of that said church, Wright set out to create a structure wherein the character and nature of God can be discovered through the participation in community. Unlike the grand cathedrals of Europe, where one can find the Stations of the Cross positioned throughout the structure, or the story of the faith told through stained glass windows, or a well-defined focal point, complete with the sort of well-established rostrum meant to make it explicit where the information should be disseminated from, Wright's structure strips the space to its essentials, and it elevates the participant, the parishioner, the worshiper, in order to be a reminder that worship is not an individual pursuit, but a communal activity that both provides and requires communal accord. a space like this allows worshipers to witness and to be witness to their fellow worshipers, their community, their, to use the evangelical language of my youth, their brothers and sisters in Christ. And this is nothing against the grand cathedrals. Obviously, those are amazing and incredible in their own way. But it's an interesting way to rethink what a church is meant to be. And so the simplistic lines that you see here sort of have this way that they drive your eye around the room. They're propelling your focus around the space in the same way that Hemingway's terse and stripped-down prose sort of propel you through his narratives. This propulsion forces us to fill in the space with ourselves because we aren't left with anything to linger on long enough to sort of explain itself to us. So in both the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright and the literature of Ernest Hemingway, the task of understanding becomes ours. Now, which makes both of these artists, I think, a perfect entry point for working through the seemingly impossible task of knowing and understanding both God and each other. Now, it's interesting to note that this is where we're going to start talking about God, for those of you that are wondering what you're doing here this morning. It's interesting to note that Hemingway, when asked about his unique writing style, often cited the King James Bible as a major influence. Now, I'm not going to break that all down, but it's easy to see how the Bible's influence on it. It's easy to see that influence on Hemingway when you look at sort of the use of repetition for emphasis, this sort of unnatural reliance on the conjunction and the narrative terseness that we've already seen. But there is also in Hemingway and the Bible a hidden complexity within the seeming simplicity of the prose. Like Hemingway and Wright, and really all modernist artists, the simplicity on display is always the result of enormous theoretical, thematic, and theological complexity that goes on below the surface. I didn't bring in any examples of like modernist painting, but you've all seen these things where there's like one line or a box or whatever, and you go, I could have painted that, what is that? Right? And that's the essence of modernism. You didn't paint it, someone else did, and that's why it's important. But I won't get into that discussion just in case there's any real modernist haters here. We can talk about it later. Anyway, so just like an iceberg that could float because the majority of its mass is below the line, Wright's architecture, Hemingway's prose, and the Bible rely on the empty space that surrounds the skeletal structure that is immediately visible. Now, maybe that goes, when we talk about the Bible, maybe that goes against what you've been told. It goes against what I've been told. I can remember being taught that the Bible is simple. Everything in there is black and white, sometimes, you know, in red, depending on what kind of Bible you have. But as I've gotten older and sort of learned more, you discover very quickly that there's an enormous, there's enormously complex ideas presented through very simple prose, and prose especially that we sort of just accept sometimes because we've been told them so much. So we're going to go through, I'm going to just grab a few passages in chronological order. Some of them are pretty common, but I think get brushed over because we think we understand. Some of them not so common. And we're going to think about what's going on here. Okay, so we'll start right at the beginning. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, and that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness, called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning of the first day. This is the New King James Version, because I wanted to cut out the these and thous just to make it easier for all of us, but same idea. So here's a verse we've all read a million times, and you say, yeah, okay, it's pretty simple, until you start to break down what does it mean to create light, what does it mean, you know, and you start to read about the Big Bang or these sorts of ideas, and all of a sudden, this is a very simplistic way to explain something enormously complicated, and that's not even getting into the conversation of what God is, what he was doing before this, what it all means. Complicated. I'm not going to dwell on it, we're going to keep moving. Here's a weird one. And it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met Moses and sought to kill him. What does that look like? Right? Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, surely you are a husband of blood to me. So he let him go. Then he said, then she said, you are a husband of blood because of the circumcision. Anyone want to explain that one? Pastor Tim? Yeah. Here's one that gets read out a lot. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. This one is read a lot, right? In churches, this is the whole justification for a lot of people, Jesus' death. This is, you know, and there's all this sort of backstory to this. That if you read this and you have a certain understanding of it, you go, well, yeah, he's talking about heaven or hell. But it doesn't say that. There's no indication of that. He says, if we take this literally and simply, like I was told to read the Bible, basically, if somebody died, they'll live if they believe in God. Whatever believing in a person means. And whoever lives and believes will never die. Well, millions, billions of people who believed in Jesus have died over the years. So what does that mean?
Well, are you sure?
Maybe, and maybe that's it. Maybe no one has ever believed in Jesus, and that's why we all die. Right? It's complicated. It's not simple. Here's another one. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to and will... sorry, I can't even read it. Both to will and to do for his good pleasure. I don't know what that means. I know what I've been told that means, but when I really look at it on its own, I realize there's a lot of my own backstory into what I think that means. Here's a fun one we can fight about. Women should adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Does that piss anyone else off? It's crazy, right?
That was very
good. I don't want to be at lunch with you guys later.
This thing wasn't hard for me to hear.
Right. So this is in the Bible. This is in the book that people say has everything you need, right? But we would read this and we would go, okay, well, we have to give this some cultural context. Exactly. We have to give it cultural context. Everything needs that. Here's one last one from Revelation, which is the simplest of all books to understand. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. Or she, of course. What is... Right, yeah, okay. Yeah. So what does that mean, right? If we take it literally, I'm not going to open that door. He's going to cut me open and get in my skin or something. I don't know what that means. And then we're going to eat together, right? It's complicated. We have a feeling for what that means, but because we've read around it, because we have a cultural understanding, that's all. That's the only point. I wanted to read all those. If anyone wants to sit around and break them down for me, feel free, but we're not going to do it right now. Because having to break it down would prove my point, that it's not simple. So, yeah, I drag all these out to make a point against the notion that the Bible, in content, theme, or syntax, is in any way a simplistic document. Maybe in the seeking of advice, for you, or after some sort of theological argument, you've heard somebody say, no, it's all in the Bible, plain and simple. The Bible has all the answers you're looking for. And while that may be true, finding that answer is never as simple as we think that it should be. Unless we're comfortable with coming at something with a set of preconceived notions and ideologies and a set of ingrained cultural or social attitudes, and knowledge through which we're going to read a given text and then be satisfied that it simply confirms what we already thought we knew. If those assumptions and understandings aren't there, the text becomes much more difficult to decipher. In the same way that the Hemingway short story, if you're aware of how classifieds work, if you have an image of what a baby, if you realize it never worn means that something happened to that baby, having the concept from your own experience of what it's like to lose somebody makes us realize the depth and the pain at hand in six words. You know, if an alien were to see the story or some real heartless jerk, they would just see this as, oh, great, baby shoes, I've been looking for those. I'm going to get them cheap, too, because they want to get rid of them. Right? It's not a poignant story of loss. It's a story of transaction. Now, I can remember when I was 17 and I was just about to start Bible school, and I was talking with a youth leader at the church that I was attending about why I wanted to study the Bible. And I said that I really wanted to understand and know everything there was to know. And when I look back on myself, I realized that probably what I really wanted was just somebody else to confirm everything I already thought I knew about it, which is probably why I struggled so much studying the Bible at the time. But the youth leader, who's not what you'd really call an academic enthusiast, told me that I should be careful about reading between the lines too much because then we lose sight of the lines themselves. At the time, I found the advice somewhat short-sighted, but clearly it was important enough for me to keep and remember all these years later. Now, I see it as just kind of small-minded and based on the sort of fear that comes from ignorance. It's like the simple lines in Wright's architecture that point us to the open air and the others who inhabit it. Like the omitted adjectives and adverbs and explanations that allow us to insert ourselves into Hemingway's prose, I now recognize that the lines exist to direct us towards the spaces between them. The spaces are the cracks that Leonard Cohen so poetically sung about. They are the cracks that let the light in. What this youth leader didn't see in his understanding of the Bible as simple is what a lot of us don't see. That's that we are always participating in interpretation. We think that the ideas presented are simple because we've already been initiated in how to understand them. We are always reading between the lines, and we are always bringing our own experience to bear on whatever we read. We are interpreting the intention of the authors, and we are acting as we're acting on established biases and worldviews, which we see the Bible as confirming. I recognize now that what this youth leader was afraid of was something that would force him outside of his sort of ignorance, and therefore would problematize a simple understanding that confirmed his belief system. This is called our confirmation bias, and it's something that we're all afraid of losing. Confirmation bias is the reason for the rise of fake news, because it feels good to read something that agrees with what you want to believe, even if that's a terrible thing. Cognitive dissonance is difficult. That's the opposite of a confirmation bias. Well, sort of. Anyway, it's difficult, and disruption is difficult, because the reality is that the only way we truly learn anything is by having our established ideas torn down so that something better can be built in its place. This is how our brain works. This is how our relationships work. And that's how society has progressed from Galileo to Columbus to Darwin to Einstein. It takes someone with the courage to tear down what came before in order to make room for something better. Life, like Hemingway, like Frank Lloyd Wright, like the scriptures, is hiding in the spaces. It's in the gaps. It's in the ruins of what came before. It's in the silence. And I used to fear silence. God's silence, the silence that awkwardly permeates the gaps in conversations, the silence of being alone. But I'm slowly starting to learn that the real story, the story of how someone else is feeling, what someone is struggling with, what makes us uncomfortable, it lives in that lack of eye contact, or in the words unsaid, in the resistance to touch, and the fear of intimacy that can define a conversation. But I've also learned that affection and love, caring, admiration, and devotion exist in small gestures, in lingering smiles, in enthusiastic handshakes, in wholehearted hugs. I've learned that God's love is a currency that trades in sunrises, in children's laughter and tears, in phone calls from friends, in family dinners, somehow.
They're not that bad.
And it exists in communities that explicitly come together, inexplicably come together for nothing more than to be good to one another. So, be good to one another. And if you have some time, read some Hemingway. Thanks a lot, everybody.